starting here on the top of Chavhei Amunalef by the two dots, Malve Beribit. Mishnah mentions a number of people who are disqualified from being Edim. As we discussed yesterday, the Mishnah seems to be speaking about Psulei Midrabanan. And one of those was Malve Beribit, someone who lends with interest. We discussed the Balei Tosafot yesterday. How could it be, after lending with interest, that's only Derabanan, should be Doraita? So Balei Tosafot suggested one of two explanations. Either that it's not Ribit Ktsutsa, it's not a fixed and explicit interest that's being charged, so therefore it's not Ribit Doraita, it's not interest min haTorah, rather Avak Ribit. Or the other possibility is, even if it is Ribit Doraita, nevertheless, people don't classify or don't consider it to be like theft, because the other party is paying it willingly. And since both parties entered it willingly, there is a perspective on it that makes it not like stealing. And so even though min haTorah it's problematic, nevertheless, we also have to look at the mindset of individuals who engage in this activity as to whether they think they're stealing or they think they're doing something wrong or not. And so that's what the Balei Tosafot suggests over here, that they don't feel like it's like stealing because both parties entered willingly. Amar Rava, Love Beribit Pasul Eidut. So Rava here introduces the other side of the puzzle, which is not only is the creditor Pasul Eidut when he lends with interest, the borrower is also Pasul Eidut when he borrows with interest and he pays interest on the loan. Mar says, Venantanan. Our Mishnah says, Malve Beribit. Says the person who lends money with interest on it. Well, if you were right, Rava, the Mishnah shouldn't say Malve, it should say Malve Vilove. The Gemara says, no, you read it wrong. It's not Malve Beribit, but rather Milve Haba'a Beribit. It is a loan that has interest on it. So it's not Malve as in creditor, but Milve as in loan. And that means that both parties, both the Malve, the creditor, and the Love, the debtor, are considered psulim or disqualified for testifying after that because they engage in lending or borrowing with Ribit. And as we said yesterday, we worry about these individuals because they have this chimud mamon, that they desire money, and therefore it causes them lavir ladat, to violate the religious principles, the Torah laws, and therefore he's a rasha de chamas. That's a rasha of chamas, which the Torah disqualifies from being an aid, because this person can be forced, quote-unquote, to violate Torah principles when it comes to money. And so since they can be convinced through money to do these things, we worry about one of two possibilities. Either they will lie or be bribed to say something, because as long as it's money, they'll do anything. Or that they do not have the proper consideration or appreciation of people who have to make a living and have difficulty doing it in an honest manner because they do it somewhat in a dishonest manner, or they're willing to cut corners. So because of either of those reasons, we disqualify them from being edim. Right, so it's true that from the borrower standpoint, you could understand why he might be in a corner and forced to borrow with a ribit, but then again, that tells the same story, which is that he's willing to violate Isser in the Torah because he needs the money. And that means that he might do the same thing. He might go and testify falsely because he needs the money. He's in a position where he can be taken advantage of because he needs money, and he's willing, in order to get that money, to violate an Isser min haTorah. So now, that's true both of the borrower and the creditor. If you remember from the Gemara in Baba Metzia, the Mishnah there says that there are other violators of the Isser Doraita of Ribit. It's not only the borrower and the lender, but it's also the Edim that sign on the document. It's also the Arev, the guarantor, as well as the Sofer who writes the document. They're all in violation, possibly, of Isurim Doraita. And why are they not mentioned over here also as being Psulim? So in that, you can understand, similar to what we mentioned before from the Balei Tosafot, that those individuals, whether it's the guarantor or they deem that sign on it, maybe they're doing something wrong, but they don't think of it as being a violation of Isser Doraita. They don't think of it as being stealing. They don't think of it as being something they're doing because of Chimud Mamon. So even though they are a party to this and they're in violation of Isser Doraita, we wouldn't classify it as being something like Chimud Mamon or Hamas that would disqualify them as Edim. On the other hand, the creditor and the debtor do have that position. The debtor either because he facilitates the creditor doing this, or because the debtor himself, like we just mentioned, is in dire straits and will do things for money. Bar Benitus, Asidu Bei, Treis Ade. So this individual, Bar Benitus, two Edim show up and testify about it. Chadamar Kamedidi Oziperibita. One of the Edim testifies that you lent with interest in front of me. I mean, you were a creditor and demanded interest in front of me from another party. The other Eid comes along and says, you lent me money with interest. So you have two Eidim testifying to the fact that this individual lends with interest. One of them saying that he's witnessed a loan taking place or a credit being extended with interest. The other one saying that he borrowed the money from this individual with interest. Pasle Rova the Barbenitus. So Rova disqualified Barbenitus from being an Eid anymore, of course from being a Dayan as well, because now he is someone that is subject to the restrictions of violating Yisrei Doraita for money, and he is considered to be an Eid Hamas, and therefore he cannot testify in the court. Vaha Rova hu de Amar lo veberi bit pasul de Eidut. Wait a minute, didn't Rova just say before that a debtor is disqualified from testifying when he borrows with interest? And that's what just happened over here. The borrower says that the other individual, Barbenitus, lent to me with interest. But then he himself is admitting to the fact that he borrowed with interest. So he disqualified himself from being an aid. Babalei Rasha. And he's a Rasha. But Torah Amra, Altashet Rasha aid. And the Pasuk says that you may not make a Rasha into an aid. Meaning that a Rasha, and we'll see the way they parse the Pasuk, but a Rasha of Hamas cannot be made into an aid. And this debtor is now testifying, and his testimony is disqualifying the creditor, even though he himself is admitting to the fact that he borrowed with interest. So Rava the Tamei, Rava is the Shitato that we saw earlier back on Tet Amud Bet, as well as we saw in the Gemara and Baba Batra, Dama Rava, Adam Karov Eitzel Atzmo, a person is considered to be a relative to himself, Vein Adam Mitzim Atzmo Rasha, and therefore a person cannot testify about himself. He can't disqualify himself, he can't make himself into a Rasha, he cannot incriminate himself. Because of that, we do not believe him with regards to his statement that he is a debtor that borrowed with interest. But we do believe him with regards to the fact that the creditor lent with interest, or in other words, we are palginan dibura, which is the way that the Gemara phrases it in other places, is that we bifurcate his statement, and we believe him with regards to the creditor, but we don't believe him with regards to himself. And we discussed back on Tet Amud Bet all the different nuances of palginan dibura as to what's the nature of the testimony and how it can be split. But over here, we are suggesting that Rava would allow that splitting of the testimony, and that we would believe him with regards to the creditor, but not about himself. So this butcher, we found out, was cheating, and he was selling animals that were trefot as kosher meat. So he's a butcher, he's entrusted to only sell kosher meat. Certain animals were trefot, and he still sold them anyway. Pasle Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman disqualified him from being an aid, the avrei, and he also removed him from his position, from his job. He took away his license to be a butcher. Azal Rabbi Maziei v'tofrei. He went ahead and he grew out his hair and his nails, meaning he was demonstrating avelut, or even nidui, excommunication, or in essence he was trying to demonstrate that he was doing tshuva for that which he had done wrong. So Rav Nachman achshurei. Rav Nachman thought to reinstate him and to say that he was kasher because he had remorse over what he had done, and therefore he was demonstrating that through the fact that he was disheveled and he was an avel over that which he had done. Amalei Rova, so Rav Nachman's Talmud Rova says to him, Dilma irume kamarim. Wait a minute, maybe he's just playing games here. Maybe he's trying to trick you into thinking that he has remorse so that he can get reinstated. How do you know that this is genuine tshuva? Elamaita kante. So then, what do you expect from him? He's doing tshuva. What more could you expect from him over here? Kedravidi ba'avin, like Ravidi ba'avin, damar Ravidi ba'avin, a chashuta l'trefot. Someone who is chashut to sell non-kosher, to sell trefot. Ein lo takana ad sheilech lemakom she'ein makirin oto. Until he goes to a location or a place where they don't recognize him. Ve'avzir aveda b'davar chashuv. And then he returns someone's lost item. That is significant. Now, it has to be significant to the finder here. It has to be something of value that would make a difference to him. So, obviously, if he's wealthy, then it'd be subjective. It'd have to be a much bigger item. If he's a poor person, then a smaller item would be chashuv to him. But the reason we want him to go to a place where ain makirim, where they don't recognize him, is because over there, he doesn't have any ulterior motives over here. He's not trying to demonstrate tshuva. He's not trying to trick anybody or convince them of his remorse in this situation. He's in a place where nobody knows what he's doing. And therefore, if he returns the Aveda and he gives up the money, we see that he is not driven by money anymore. And so he has then done real tshuva. Oh, shiotzi treifa mitachat yado b'davar chashuv mishalo. Or he has a treifa that's found in his animals and he lets it go. He says it's a treifa, and despite the monetary loss, he swallows it and lets it go. So here you have a much higher standard of tshuva for the butcher. We don't just say that if he demonstrates tshuva or he acts in a way that seemingly is doing tshuva, that's not enough. We require that he take action that demonstrates to us that he has done wholehearted tshuva and that he's no longer drawn by money or he's no longer going to be swayed by profits in order to do something wrong. And so he either has to do this by going to a place where nobody recognizes him. And Rashi says over here, the reason for that is that then we know that he's not faking it. Then we know that he's not doing it in order to give an impression of tshuva, because there's nobody there. And so then when he acts there to return money, that's a demonstration of genuine tshuva, and then we would believe him. There is some sort of circular logic in that, because if he's in a place where nobody recognizes him, then how do we ever know that that event took place? If we do know that event took place, then that would be a reason for him to fake the event, or to be ma'arim, because we're going to know about it eventually. So there is somewhat of a circular logic there, and so it's hard to know how we verify the information, because once we verify it, it means that he's doing it in order to get it verified later on, and then you're back to square one. But the idea being suggested over here is that this butcher needs a lot more in terms of tshuva than simply demonstrating a little remorse or acting in a way that seemingly indicates tshuva because of the way that he is disheveled and the way that he is acting. Now, the Rishonim over here ask why that is, that you need more tshuva over here. Why is there such a high standard? So the Ran quotes from the Rambam and says that it's because the butcher was entrusted with a public position. He was given a position in which not only was he supposed to be honest, but the public relied on him to do the right thing. And since he did something wrong that not only was an aveira for him, but then caused other people to do aveirot, and he breached and abused the public trust, therefore in order to regain the public trust, he has to have a much higher threshold there. The Rabbeinu David says that we are more strict over here is because he lost his job because of his aveira. And therefore we are a suspect of him being remorseful in order to get his job back, and not because he really is genuinely doing tshuva. So we have suspicions of ulterior motives over here, and that's why we take a precaution, or we have a higher standard for the butcher in this case. Mafrichei yonim. So the Mishnah mentions mafrichei yonim, which now the Gemara asks, my mafrichei yonim. What exactly is this mafrichei yonim? Hacha targamua. So over here they explained it. I tekadme yonach leyon. Did your bird come before my bird? Or in essence, racing birds, or racing any type of animal, whether it's dog races, horse races, or bird races, pigeon races, that's what we're referring to in the Mishnah. Rabbi Chama Barushaya Amar Ara. Literal translation of the word is a fowler, but it seems to be that this Ara is someone who can attract birds. He has methodologies by which he can attract the birds to come to him, and therefore we are worried about the fact that he takes other people's birds or other people's possessions Baal Korchan, against their will. Since he has this method by which it's so compelling for the animals to come to him, he's able to then cause other people's animals to abandon or leave their place by them and come to him. And so there's a problem of gezel, at least gezel mi derabanan, or mipnei darchei shalom. Again, the Gemara in a second will discuss more in detail how he does this. Manda mar, itakad me yonach the yon, the one who says that it's racing birds, maitama lo amar ara. Why didn't he say that it's the fowler? Amalacha ara mipnei darchei shalom ba'alma. That the problem by the ara is not a problem of gezel, it's a problem of darchei shalom. Which we also learned in the Gemara as well, which is that when it comes to certain type of theft, it's not real theft. Because the owners of the item aren't really owners. They never take possession of it. And that's true by birds. We said that by the dovecotes. When the doves come and set up shop in your field, it's not because you made a kinyan on the doves. They fly freely away. They come back because you provided them a place to nest and it happens to be comfortable for them over there. But you never made a kinyan. There's nothing there that gives you halachic ownership over them. But, mipnei darchei shalom, because it's good neighborly manners, etiquette, to not take your friend's birds, we want people to be able to keep their yonim and not have other people snatching them away or trying to steal them away. And therefore, because of darchei shalom, we tell you don't take someone else's yonah, or don't set up another dovecote within range of the birds that are in your friend's fields. So that's all because of Darkei Shalom. It's not because of Gezel, because nobody really owns the birds. The birds are Hefker, both when they live in the dovecote of your friend and when they live in your dovecote. And so for that reason, he says, that's not a compelling reason to disqualify an individual from being an aide, because there's no Gezel over here. According to one who says it's the fowler, why doesn't he say that it's about the bird races? Because that's identical to Misachek Bekubya, meaning that one is gambling and one is gambling. It's gambling by dice or it's gambling by racing. There's no difference between them, and therefore there's no reason to duplicate that in the Mishnah. So that is actually a serious question on the other opinion over here as to why we would say that you'd have Misachek Bekubya and you'd have bird racing. And that's what the next thing the Gemara deals with, which is Ve'idach. The other opinion who says that it is bird racing says to you that you're talking about two different types of gambling over here. Tana tole b'dat atzmo, b'tana tole b'dat yono. Because in each of these cases, there's a different type of reliance by the owner. When it comes to gambling with the dice versus the racing of the birds, b'tzricha, you need both of them. Because itana tole b'dat atzmo, when it comes to the rolling of the dice, ha'atam hu d'lo gamar amakne. Over there, he doesn't full-heartedly give in and give his money, because he believes the Amar Kimli b'nafshai yadana tfe, says, I am smarter, better at this gambling, and I for certain know that I'm going to win in this case, because I can influence the outcome of the dice. I know how to roll the dice better. I know how to play the cards better. Or, like they found in the archaeological digs by the Harabayit, and they found a die there, they saw that the die was weighted, and that it would always fall in one number. So of course he knew which number it was going to come out on, because it was a weighted die. But this guy knows how to play the dice or the cards, he thinks, and therefore he's not going to think that he might lose over here. He really thinks he's going to win. And therefore he's not makne the money. When it comes to the birds, he says, I don't have any control over that. That's up to the birds. And therefore he relinquishes control. As we saw yesterday, that when you relinquish control, you think you have no influence over the matter, there's no longer any asmachta, because you are gomer umakne. Versus a case where you think you can influence the outcome, over there you're not gomer umakne, because you think that you're actually going to come out a winner over there. So you don't give up your money, or you don't relinquish control over your money. Ve'i tana tola b'dat yono, if it only mentioned the birds case, racing, dar v'naksha talya milta, because he says it has to do with the clappers. They're not sure the clappers that they used to chase the birds with or have them move faster. So I'm a better clapper and I can get the bird to move faster. Or I have a better jockey that can get the horse to move faster. Whatever your reasoning is, you think you have influence or control over the animal that is racing. And therefore you're not going to be gomer makne, because you feel that relinquishing it to chance, you have control. And when you have control, you're not gomer makne. And I know how to clap faster, I have a better jockey, I know how to deal with this. About tola b'dat atzmo, aim alo. But in a game of chance where it's cards, it's roulette, it is gambling with dice, in those cases, it's all a numbers game, it's all a game of chance and probability. And over there, you relinquish control to the probability, and therefore you're gomer makne. Tzricha, that's why you need both cases of Mishnah to tell you, in both those instances, you are disqualified. So, in essence, what he's suggesting is that the problem here, in both of these instances, is the problem of asmachta, and the asmachta depends on the fact that you think you have control. And what we're seeing here is that you think you have control in both of these instances. You think you might have control by the birds, and you think you might have control by the dice or by the cards. And so therefore, you do not give over full control, and therefore you would say that there's a problem of asmachta here, and asmachta lo kanya. On the other hand, the view of the arrow of the fowler might be actually dealing with the fact that he doesn't believe that the gambling in the Mishnah is an asmachta. Or in essence, it is the machloka that we saw yesterday between Rami Bar Chama and Rav Sheshet. Rami Bar Chama thinks the problem in the Mishnah is asmachta. And according to him, that's why the two cases of the Mishnah need to be brought, both the Yonim and the gambling case of the dice, because both of those involve a question as to whether there is an asmachta or not. And that's what Mishnah is telling us, there is an asmachta in both those cases. Rav Sheshet, who said the problem in the Mishnah is Ishuvo Shalolam, is that you're not engaged in productive, constructive activity. So for him, racing birds is no different than Misachek Bekubya. And therefore, you would have to come up with the other answer, which is Va'ara of the fowler. So that's what the Ran does over here. He connects between the Machloket we saw yesterday and the Machloket that we're seeing over here. But what you see is that these two opinions differentiate or differ on whether the Mafricha Yonim over here is racing the birds, or is it somehow capturing or alluring the birds into your traps. So now the Gemara says, Meitave. So now we have a Braita that seems to question these positions. Nam Sechek Bekubya. What is playing with dice? Ilhenem Sechekim. Bepispasim. This is a person who plays with little wood chips or little stone chips. In modern Hebrew, pisifas is the stones that are used in a mosaic. And so that's what it means here. It means small dice or a small square that they use for these games. Velo pispasim bilvad, not only these small items. Amru ela afilu klipe eguzim klipe rimonim. Even if he's using the shells of the nuts or the shells of the pomegranates, which is something that he would do on a more temporary basis. It's just a game for fun right now. It's not something that you would play with all the time. All of these are problematic in terms of Mesachek Bekubya. Ve'ematai chazaratan. And when are you considered to be cured of this problem, or that you've done tshuva that we don't worry about anymore? Mishbiru et pispisehem. When you break the dice that you use, when you rid yourself of the tools of gambling, it's not enough that you do tshuva and you say you're not going to do it anymore. It's not enough that you have disavowed gambling. You actually have to break the vices that would bring you to gamble again. And they do full tshuva, that you would not even gamble for free. Meaning you won't do it for fun, but you're just playing a game of cards or a game of dice where there's no money involved. That's how we know you've really done tshuva, is when you forsake gambling completely, whether it's for money or whether it's not for money. You don't get engaged in it at all. And the same is true in all these other cases. Malveh beribit, a person who lends with interest, echad amalveh v'echad aloveh, similar to what Rava said on the previous amud, which is it doesn't matter if it's the creditor or the debtor. Ve'ematai chazaratan, and how do they do tshuva? Mishikaru et shtarehen, when they rip up the documents that evidence the fact that they lent and they're entitled to the interest. Ve'yachzru ben chazarag murah, and then they do full tshuva to the point, afilu nachri lo musfei. They don't lend to interest, even to the non-Jew. The restriction in the Torah to lend with interest is only to your brother, to a Jew. To a non-Jew, you're permitted to lend with interest. So what it says here is that even permissible interest you don't take, that's a sign of true tshuva. U'mafrichei yonim, when it comes to the mafrei yonim, elu she mamrim et yonim. These are those that are mamrim et yonim, and this is what leads to all the different explanations as to what this ara is. Rashi over here says, mamrim et yonim, Margizimotan zel zelihilachem, that you encourage them, you incite them to fight with each other. So that would be more like a cockfight rather than the racing of the birds. That's what Rashi seems to be describing over here, which presents a little bit of a problem because before the Gemara seems to indicate in Mafriche Yonim is that they race the birds, or my bird came first before your bird. So what you have to say is that it's not that whether your bird comes first or not, it's whoever is the surviving bird. Either your bird gets there first, or your bird eliminates the other bird, and therefore it's going to get there first because it eliminates it. Something along those lines. So that's what Rashi says that the Mamrim is over here. If you look in the Aruch, which is quoted here on the side, you can say, Perish Lashon Moreh. It's to teach the bird. Klomar, Milamdim Oto Lifroach Lakdim Leonim Acherim. You teach it to fly faster, or you teach it to go ahead of other birds. So that's what he says here. Or you teach it to attract other birds. And you can see that in their Beinu Chananel. Their Beinu Chananel over here says, Perish Ara, Koshrim Chut Aruch Ba'of. You tie the bird with a long string, Umafrichim Oto Bagag. And then you take it up on the roof, and you have it fly, but it's on a string. Mitzafzifim, and then it goes ahead and it tweets, and it sings. And by doing that, Mitkabsin Tzvibotav Ofot Shel Bnei Adam. And that causes other people's birds to be attracted, Minashovchim Acherim, from the other dovecotes. So it is a plant that you put there. You teach this dove how to attract other birds, and it whistles and sings in order to attract the birds. But you have it tied so that it can't fly away, and so all the other birds come to it, and then you capture those birds. So that's the moreh here. The moreh is either you teach it how to fly faster, or the moreh over here is that you teach it how to sing and attract the other birds. What's interesting about the word is that the modern Hebrew Hamra'ah means to take off. And so Mamrim et Yonim is teaching them to fly, you're teaching them to take off. So that would accord with what we saw in the Aruch, that you teach them how to fly or to move fast that would match with the way that we read the word today. There's another explanation, which is that the clappers that you use, like Rashi suggests over here, is in order to scare the other birds away from where they are in their dovecotes, and then you use this bird as a ploy to pull them in. So you shake them out of their dovecotes by clapping on the wood and causing them to fly away, and then once they're in flight already, they're attracted to the sound of the bird that you trained. Those are different perspectives on to what exactly is being done by this arrow over here, and they're trying to explain the word mamrim et yonim, velo yonim bilvad amru, ela afilu beima chaya ve'of. It's not only true by birds, but it's true of animals as well, which the Gemara will then discuss about how does that connect to what we're saying over here. Ve'imatai chazaratan, and when is it considered that they did tshuva? Mishis biru et pigmehen, when they break the wood. So now Rashi claims over here, pigmehem is eudapim shemizazim behem. Those are the clappers that they use to cause the birds to move fast, or what Rashi said before, to incite the birds to fight with each other. That's what you're breaking over here. You're breaking those clappers. Those are the tools of the trade, and you break them. That's one possibility. The other possibility is shishbu et pigmehem, based on the Rabbeinu Chananel, is that the bird that you fly up on a string, you tie him to a piece of wood. That wood is called pigmehem, and so when you break that wood so you can no longer keep the bird tethered, that's when you've done tshuva. Or the other possibility is that the pigmehem are either the traps or the clappers that cause the other birds to fly away and then be attracted to you, that you break them. Ve'achzuru behem chazara gmura, and then you do full tshuva, ta'afilu b'midbar lo amnami lo abde, that you don't even do it out in the midbar, in a place where it's hefker, where there's no problem of taking the birds. You don't even do this, or you don't practice this out there, that's an indication that you've done tshuva. What's interesting about this is that the tshuva that is being noted over here is only relevant for the ara, for the person who says that mafrichei yonim is ara. According to the one who says mafrichei yonim is racing the birds, the tshuva should be the same tshuva as misachek bekubya. And that's what Rashi notes over here. He says this is not a part of the braita. This is something that the chazal or the gemara is adding in to explain the tshuva. And he says the high perushala lishna the ara nokidla. This explanation of tshuva is clearly favoring or only speaking about the case of ara, the case of the person who attracts the birds. But for the person who's racing, Rashi says the tshuva will be the same as misachek bekubya, which means that he doesn't race the birds even for free. He doesn't even do it just for fun. That would be a sign of him doing tshuva. Sochare shvi'it. There are these sochare shvi'it, which we'll spend more time on tomorrow's daf, explicating on that. These are people who traffic, who trade in perot shvi'it. And we know that in the Torah it says, v'ochla v'lo l'schora, that you're allowed to eat the perot shvi'it, you're not allowed to transact or trade in perot shvi'it. And so here they're in violation of that Isur d'oraita. Again, it's chimud mamon. They're willing for money to violate that din d'oraita. The eimatai chazaratan. So what is tshuva for people who are sochrei shvi'it? You should tagia shvi'it acheret v'yibadlu. When another shvi'it comes and they don't do it in the future. V'amar Rabbi Nechemia, lo chazarat dvarim bilvad amru. It's not enough just to articulate or to say that you're going to do tshuva. Ela chazarat mamon. You need to return the money. Ketzad. What do you have to do over here? Omer ani ploni bar ploni kinasti matayim zuz beperot shvi'it. I profited from trafficking or trading in perot shvi'it. And those profits which I took in that are illegal profits, I'm giving them out to the poor people, which would have been what happened to those perot shvi'it. They're hefker, and therefore the aniim, or those that needed them, would have come and taken them. So you are doing tshuva by disgorging the ill-gotten profits that you have from trading in perot shvi'it. So but here, it's not clear as to whether Rabbi Nechemia fundamentally disagrees with the previous reason. The previous reason says that you have to wait until the next shvi'it. So it's not clear whether Rabbi Nechemia says you don't have to wait until the next shvi'it, all you have to do is disgorge the profits, or does Rabbi Nechemia require not only do you wait to the next shvi'it, but you also must disgorge the profits. So what's clear is the first answer will require you to wait till the next shvi'it, so it'll be another 7 years before you can get qualified again. According to Rabbi Nechemia, is he offering an alternative way to get qualified earlier by disgorging the profits, or is he saying you have to wait for the next shvi'it and disgorge the profits? So that's not clear over here. Now, let's just deal with the question of the Gemara, and then we'll come back and discuss this in more detail. Katana mihat behema. It says in the case by the mafrichei yonim that this could be done not only by birds, but also by animals. Bishlam alamandamar itikad meyonach leon. According to the one who says that they were racing birds, then you can have animals race. You can have dogs race, horse races. You can have all different types of races. So it makes sense when it says it's not only applicable to yonim, it's applicable to any animal. Now, the mandamar aro, according to the one who says that it's about capturing these birds, that he has some methodology, and we discussed the different mechanisms that he has in order to capture them, that makes sense when you're talking about a bird. Behema bat hachihi, but when you're talking about an animal, it doesn't work that way. So the difference being is that we're talking about domesticated animals over here. You're talking about a behema is an animal that stays in the barn, an animal that stays with you and is domesticated. You can't use an animal like that to attract other animals. If you let a domesticated animal or an animal that lives on the farm out into the wild animals will not be attracted to it. They'll actually chase it away because it's not used to being out there in that competitive environment. And so an animal would not be a lure for other animals. When it comes to birds, there, the birds are free-spirited, and even when you have them, quote-unquote, domesticated, the yonim, nevertheless, they still fly freely. They come back and forth to their nests there, but you don't have them really captured. And so therefore, you can use your bird to attract the other birds. But by a behema, it's not possible to do that. And so that's what the Gemara is saying. What type of lure or what type of animal can you do this with? The Gemara says, in bishora bar. We're talking about the wild ox, whatever that means, whether it's a non-domesticated ox, or it means that it's of some other species, which is actually a machloket about what the status of bishora bar is. Ukamad amar shora bar min behemahu. It's according to the one who says that a shora bar is classified as a behema. So machloket, as we're going to see now, that's not shora bar, the wild ox, min behemahu. That's the position of the Chachamim in the Tanakhama. Rabbi Yossi omer min chaya, that it's actually a wild animal. It's an animal that is not domesticated, doesn't stay in. So therefore, if you believe it is a behema, it's a type of animal that lives on the farm, but it's wild enough that it can handle itself in the wild, or it can lure other animals. And so that's a type of behema, which is really a wild animal. And since it's really a wild animal, it can go out and lure other animals in or help you to round up or attract other animals. And so that will be the explanation of the Braita. So now, with regards to the Braita, I want to deal with two things. First of all, in terms of the tshuva that is being done here, what is very interesting is the prescription for tshuva. Normally, when we talk about the prescription for tshuva, we know that tshuva involves four things, which is that a person has to have hakarat hacheit, person has to have remorse over the eight, harata. Person has to have vidui. Person has to admit and articulate what they have done. And then they need a kabbalah latid. They need to accept in the future that they won't go back to doing this item again. Now, this braita seems to prescribe things that are different than that. It's not enough kabbalah latid in this braita. This braita requires a much stricter and severe type of remediation in order for you classified to be doing tshuva. So it's very interesting that Rav Soloveitchik in Ala Tshuva discusses the different types of tshuva. And over there in one of the essays, he describes the difference between kapara and tahara. He says that kapara is the gaining of atonement, which is the forgiveness of the sin, as if you get a shield or protects you from the punishment that would be associated with the sin. But there's also a concept called tahara, that is to cleanse oneself of the sin, or to remove the sin completely from the individual to the point where the gavra is a new gavra now. It's a different person because he's now eliminated this entirely. I'll just read you a couple of lines from that essay where he discusses exactly what's being brought up in this bright over here. He says, "B'tshuva shel tahara." When it comes to doing tshuva, that is not just atonement, but tshuva of tahara, of purity and cleansing oneself, "lo maspik lifrosh min hacheit." It's not enough to leave the sin. You have to leave not only the sin itself, but you have to leave the environment. You have to take away the environment, the facilitating devices that allow the person to get to this chait. It's not enough just to not sin anymore. You have to eliminate the items that would draw the person back to doing the sin again. You have to change your environment completely. Shnei minei pishot yesh. There are two different types of distancing oneself. Achat pisha min achet. One is distancing oneself from the sin. Sheni pisha mi derech chatayim. And the other one is leaving the way or the path of sin. Achet hu pri shel avira misuyemet. A sin is always a result or a product of a specific type of environment. And therefore, you have to eliminate that environment. So when it comes to kapara, maspika charata, just remorse is enough in that case in terms of kapara. On the other hand, when one wants to attain tahara, then that doesn't suffice. It's not enough just to have remorse. You have to now change the environment in which you find yourself. And that's what the Braita is describing over here. The tshuva of the Braita is someone who's not only having remorse over what they did, they are making a clean break with their past. And what's so interesting about this is that if you go to the programs that they have, this 10-step programs they have for Alcoholics Anonymous or for Gamblers Anonymous, this is exactly the basis for the remediation of those individuals. The only way that they are able to go through rehabilitation is when they stop drinking alcohol whatsoever. That means not only they don't drink alcohol, abusing it, but even for Kiddush, they can't drink alcohol anymore. And that's why they drink grape juice instead for Kiddush. That was a famous question. Rabbi Dr. Twersky mentions it in some of his speeches, that when they were doing the program with the 10 steps, that when it comes to Jews who are in the program, so for Kiddush, they use grape juice, because we have the psak of Rav Moshe and other of the poskim that say that grape juice is fine for Kiddush, even though it is definitely very controversial in the time of the Rishonim, but here in most of the modern day poskim, they say that grape juice is fine. So there was this individual, I don't know if he was a member of the church or he was a priest, and he needed to do the sacraments. And so the problem was that the sacraments involved wine. And so they didn't know what to do. He was now a rehabilitated alcoholic, and he wanted to do the sacraments. What do they do about the wine? So I think they sent the question to whether it was the archbishop or the pope, and they asked what they should do in this case. So I think that they sent back and asked, what do the Jews do for their religious ceremonies? And they said that they use grape juice. And the answer that came back from the archbishop or the pope was, if the grape juice is good enough for the Jews, then it's good enough for the sacraments for us. And so that's how he said that they dealt with the issue. But that's a very much integral to these ideas of rehabilitation. And the same thing with gambling. When it comes to a person who was a problem with gambling, then he may not be involved in anything close to gambling. It means not playing the lottery. It means not playing cards just for fun. It means not involved maybe even in investing, because it's too similar, too close in nature to that which caused the problem, and you have to eliminate that environment completely. And so what the Braita is describing here is exactly that type of remediation and rehabilitation, which is eliminating the environment that would facilitate or allow the person to return to their previous ways, because you're breaking the dice. You are throwing away the interest-bearing documents. You are doing things that where even if it was permitted, you don't get involved, in order to show or demonstrate that you have done a complete tshuva over here. That's with regards to the tshuva that's mentioned in the Braita, and it's an important distinction in tshuva, the difference between kapara and tahara, as well as the difference between atonement and one eliminating or changing the individual who's there into a new person so that they will not ever go back to these ways. As the Rav Soloveitchik says, that they get out of the derech hataim. It's not just that they left the chait, but they've left the derech hataim. Okay, now, the Gemara says over here, Tana, Hosifu alehem magazlanim v'chamsanim. They added on top of the individuals mentioned in our Mishnah, thieves and chamsanim. We'll talk in a second about what is the chamas. Gazlan, doraitahu. What do you mean? If the Mishnah is dealing with issues derabanan, why are you mentioning gazlan over here? Gazlan is a problem in a Torah. You don't even need a Mishnah to tell you this. You don't need to add that on. It's clear from the psukim that you're not allowed to have a person who engages in gezel be an aid. That's the pasuk in the Torah. Where it says, lo nitzrecha ela mitziat cheresh shoteh v'katan. It's to do with a lost item of a cheresh shoteh v'katan. Mi kara savar. Originally, the Chachamim thought, mitziat cheresh shoteh v'katan lo shchicha. It doesn't happen so often. And we know from the Mishnayot in Gitin that mipnei darchei shalom, they instituted that the mitziat of a cheresh shoteh v'katan would belong to them, and that other people couldn't grab it away or take it away from them. Even though they don't have the capacity to make a kinyan, they don't have the ability to make ownership of the item, nevertheless, for Bipnei Darchei Shalom, we did not allow others to take it. So originally they thought these types of incidents didn't come up so often. So if somebody snatched away something from a Cheresh Shoteh V'Katan, that we wouldn't, by that, disqualify them from being an aid. Inami Bipnei Darchei Shalom Ba'alma. Or, we don't classify it as Gezel because it was Darchei Shalom. Came in the chazut the sof sof memonahu. In the end, when the rabbi saw that this was a monetary issue, the kashakle, and they were taking it, meaning that people who did this was an indication or precursor to a person who acts improperly with other people's money. That it was an indication of theft or a person who wasn't concerned with other people's ownership. Paslinu Rabbanan. At that point, the Rabbanan say that they were pasul. So the Rabbanan saw that even though it was either only because of Darkei Shalom or it wasn't Shchiach, still it was an indication of the nature of the person. And since that was the indication, they said that that would disqualify the person from being an eight. Hacham Sanim. Now, Hamas, the Gemara in Baba Kama makes a distinction between a gazlan and a chamsan. A gazlan steals something, grabs it away, theft, without paying for it. A chamsan is someone who takes something and pays for it, compensates the individual for the item that they took. And so now the Gemara explains. Mi kara savor, they originally thought, dmei ka yohayv. So that's they're paying money for it, even though they're stealing it, technically, because they are compelling the individual to sell it to them. But nevertheless, they are paying for it. So they thought ekrai ba'almahu. It was just a happenstance. It was something that was not regular in nature. And therefore they said, you know what, we're not going to disqualify the individual because it's an outlier. It's not an indication of the true individual. Came into chazud kachatve. When they start to see that they were snatching it, gazru barabanan. Then the Rabbanan instituted that these people would also be disqualified from being edim. Now what happened here with chatve? Rashi says over here, they were still paying for it, but they were not getting permission. Whereas in the past, where they took it against the will of the owner and compensated for them, they would spend the time to appease the owner and finally convince him to say, Rotseani. Even though he really didn't want to sell it, they compelled him to sell it, but he acquiesced in the end. Chatve was that they didn't bother with that. They just took it and threw the money at them and said, you know what, I'm taking it, here's your money. And they never appeased the owner. That's the way Rashi reads it. Others say that the chatfe over here is literally that they took it. They stopped compensating. Originally, they would take it and compensate, and then that ladder deteriorated into a situation which people then just start to take and not compensate for it. And then it deteriorated into gezel. So what the chachamim did was that when it started as chamas, they disqualified these individuals because they knew that it would deteriorate in the end to be gezel. And so they preemptively disqualified them because people who demonstrated this type of behavior of chamas ended up chatfe in the end, end up as gazlanim in the end. And so they did that to disqualify them, even though they have yet to be gazlanim. Now, over here, the Balei HaTosafot ask a question that has serious ramifications with regards to some of the Isurim in the Torah. And that is, Tosafot over here says, Vim tomar velifso midoraita. Why aren't they disqualified min haTorah? Dekam alvar alav de lo tachmod. They're violating the Isur de Oraita of the Ten Commandments of Lo Tachmod. Do not covet other people's property. So here, what are you doing? You are coming, coveting somebody else's property, and then you go to take it and you compensate for it. But what you're doing is Lo Tachmod. You're coveting it, and if you want it, you take it and you compensate for it. The Balei Tosafot would say that Chimud Mamon is exactly what the problem is over here. And why isn't this person disqualified midoraita? So the Balei Tosafot give two answers. They are more explicit or explicate on it in the Gemara in Baba Metziah, but they have major nafkamino. The first one is, Ve'yesh lomar, delo tachmod mashma, delo ya demei. A lo tachmod is only when you don't pay for it. It's when you take it and you don't compensate for it. If you compensate for it, then you're not in violation of lo tachmod. That's the first answer of the Balei Tosafot, even though the Gemara in Baba Metziah seems to indicate otherwise. The Gemara in Baba Metziah says, on the bottom of Heyam Udbet, the last line there, the Gemara says, that people think that lo tachmod is only when you don't pay. Seemingly, what the Gemara is saying is that they don't realize that lo tachmod is even a violation when you do pay. So the Balei Tosafot say, no, that's what people think, and they're right. That's how he reads the Gemara over there. It's a more difficult reading of the Gemara. But he suggests that lo tachmod is only violated when you don't pay. That's the first answer of the Balei Tosafot. Od yesh lomar, dehocha achi kamar. Demeka yoyi vayu mefaisino tan achimer rotze ani. If he says Rotzeani in the end, if he acquiesces in the end, there's not a violation of Lo Tachmod. But if he never agrees in the end, then there is a violation of Lo Tachmod. Those are the two answers that the Balei Tosafot give. One answer is that Lo Tachmod only applies when you steal without compensating. And the second answer says, no, you can be in violation of Lo Tachmod even when you pay for it. That's only when you don't get the acquiescence of the selling party. If you convince him, even by a little bit of duress, a little bit of pressure, you convince him to sell it, then he says, Rotzani, you're not in violation of Lo Tachmod. But what comes out from the Balei HaTosafot is in order to be in violation of Lo Tachmod, in the end you either have to steal, or you have to take it, compensate without getting permission from the party. Now that is subject to a major machloket HaRishonim. I'll send you the Mikorot later. But there's a question in the Rishonim as to whether you can violate Lo Tachmod simply by thinking or coveting, being jealous of another party. The Ibn Ezra makes it clear that you can violate Lo Tachmod by simply coveting the other person's property. You do not have to act on it. So there, the Ibn Ezra says some people think that the Torah doesn't dictate how you should think, and the Torah doesn't dictate how you should feel. And therefore they say it can't be in violation of Lo Tachmod simply by thinking or feeling a certain way. And the Ibn Ezra says you couldn't be farther from the truth. The Torah does dictate, and the Torah does tell you how to feel and how to think, and coveting is a violation, an iser d'oraita, if you covet your friend's property, even if you do not act on it, even if you never steal, even if you never take it. And he says the antidote to that, or the way to deal with it, is that a person has to realize that what belongs to your friend is not in your reach. It's not something that belongs to you. You have to train yourself that God gave it to them, not to you. And you will never get to it. And that's the proper mindset that a person has to have in order to eliminate those thoughts of coveting. So there the Ibn Ezra is clear that you can violate Lo Tachmod even without acting upon it. There are other Rishonim that disagree with the Ibn Ezra and suggest that the violation of Lo Tachmod can only be accomplished if you actually act upon it. If you steal or you do something to exercise that jealousy and fulfill that desire. And so they believe that in the end you have to do something or act on it in order to be in violation. That seems to be the view of the Balei HaTosafot. Now there is a middle view which then takes on more strength because the Rambam has this view that Lo Tachmod and Lo Titaveh are actually two different Isurim that are found in the Aseret HaDibrot. The Ibn Ezra actually says something similar. It's so wild what the Ibn Ezra says that it's almost difficult to deal with, which is that the Ibn Ezra in one place says that people make a mistake to differentiate between Lo Tachmod and Lo Titaveh, and they are synonymous. In his Perush, in another location, the Ibn Ezra says that Lo Tachmod and Lo Titaveh are two different Isurim, so much so that they're counted as two different Dibrot. They are the 9th and 10th Dibrot. Lo Tachmod is 9, Lo Titaveh is 10. Now you have a problem because the Ibn Ezra now has 11 Dibrot when they're only Aseret HaDibrot. And so the Ibn Ezra has to go back then and claim that Anochi and Lo Yelecha is one Dibra in order to accommodate the fact that Lo Tachmod and Lo Titaveh are two different Isurim. And the Rambam seemingly has something along those lines, which then is discussed then by many of the Rishonim afterwards, which is that the Rambam says that Lo Tachmod is different than Lo Titaveh. Lo Titaveh is something that happens in your heart. It's about desire. It's about the thoughts and the feelings that you have. Lo Tachmod is something that you act upon. And so therefore the Rambam says that you're only in violation of Lo Tachmod if you act upon that jealousy, which means that you then go and convince others to go and discuss it with this individual. You buy something that's individual, meaning that you did something to facilitate that jealousy that you had. And now the Rambam doesn't say it comes to you illegally. It might even be legally that it comes into your possession. But since you desired it, and by desiring it, you then carried out the ability to get into your possession, even legally, you're in violation of Lo Tachmod. Lo Titaveh means that you're in violation if you think of a methodology to get it to yourself. You're not only jealous, but you also think of the mechanisms by which you could get this into your possession. You'll be in violation of the Isur. So unlike the Ibn Ezra, who thinks just the jealousy or the coveting itself is problematic, the Rambam still needs you to do more than that. Yes, you have to plan. You have to come up with a way to get the object into your possession. But that's enough. You don't have to act on it. And therefore, the Rambam writes that Tava leads to Chimud, and Chimud leads to Gezel. And he sees that as being a continuum. The Tava is the thought process, which is the jealousy and the planning to get into your possession. The Chimud is acting upon that and bringing it into your possession. And then that leads to Gezel, because in the end, when you can't get it, you're going to end up stealing it. And so that's how the Rambam views it as being a continuum. Again, differentiated from those that believe that you need to take action to be in violation, because he has Lo Titaveh. Differentiated from those that think just the thought is problematic, because he requires you to plan at least something. And differentiated from the Balei HaTosafot here, clearly, who require you to act or steal and do something illegal in order to be considered in violation of Lo Tachmod. It's a very interesting topic, and it runs the gamut in terms of opinions through the Rishonim. Alright, so now the Gemara continues and says, Tana Oroin, Hagabain, Vamoksin. They added on to the list of the Mishnah additional individuals, the Ro'im are the shepherds, Gabaim and Mochsim are both tax collectors, but the Gabaim are people appointed by the government to collect the income tax, the poll tax, the land tax. Mochsim are basically customs officials. People could set up toll booths along the way, whether it's on the rivers or places like that, and they collect taxes. So now Gemara says, Ro'im mi kara savur ekrai ba'almu. When it came to the shepherds, they originally thought it was just happenstance. It was, by chance, the animals went and grazed in other people's fields. Came into Chazud to come kavne b'shadu l'chatchila, when they saw that the people were intentionally sending their animals to graze in other people's fields, or they were taking the feed from other people's fields and giving it to their animals. I mean, they did it intentionally. Gazrubu Rabbanan. Then the Rabbanan goes there by the Ro'im, that the default status of a shepherd would be to be disqualified from being an aide because of the fact that they usually end up in these circumstances of stealing. Gabaim v'mochsim. Mi kavar sover maidekayitzlu kashakle. That they only took what they were properly entitled to take, or that was set, the fixed limit was set. Kevin dechazu dekashakle yeteira paslinhu. When they saw they started to take more, then they were disqualified. Now, the question is whether that applies both to Gabaim and Mochsim. That's the way that Rashi reads it over here. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Chananu brings from the Gaon. He says, Amar Gaon Zatzal, Hani Mochsim, Lav Mishum Deshakle Tvei B'may Dukaitzlo. It's in the last line of Rabbeinu Chananu. The problem by the Mochsim is not that they take more than they're entitled to. That's the problem for the Gabaim. Pasun Rabbanan, Dihocho, Hani Gabaim. Then they'd be identical or synonymous with the Gabaim. Ella, the problem is, Kevin Duchazi Rabbanan, Hani Mochsim, Shemarichem Ha'am, because there's a fixed amount that's supposed to take from people. Whether it's assessed based on their income or the merchandise that they're moving, there is a rate that they're supposed to charge. But what we see is that they favor different parties. They let some people go paying less, and they charge some other people more. Or in essence, they're not fair in the way that they charge the taxes. They lighten the burden on some, and they make the burden heavier on others. And that's the problem by the Mochsim, which is that they are partial to who they charge the taxes to. They don't do it in a fair manner or an even-handed manner. And that's why they're considered to be thieves or problematic, is because they let money convince them about whether they should charge or not charge the individual. And many point out that it's actually the richer people that they give the break to, and then the poorer people that they make the demands to pay in full or even more than full, because they're wealthier individuals. Either they're socially in the same circles as them, or the richer individuals have recourse or an ability to fight back against them, whereas the poor people can be taken advantage of. And for that reason, that's why the Gaon, according to Rabbeinu Chananu, disqualifies the Mochsim, not like the Gabaino, though Rashi thinks that the disqualification is the same for both of them, which is that they overcharge. So Amar Rava, Ro'esh Amru, when they talk about shepherds over here, Echad Ro'eh Behema Daka, Echad Ro'eh Behema Gasa. Doesn't matter if they are shepherding small animals, or if they're shepherding large animals. Doesn't matter if they're digging sheep or cattle. Umi amar rova hachi, did Rova really say this? Amar rova ro'eh behema daka be'eretz Yisrael psulim. That a person who grazes animals that are smaller, the sheep in, or flock animals, in Eretz Yisrael, they're pasul to be an aid. B'chutz la'aretz k'sherim. But if they do it outside of Eretz Yisrael, that's fine. Ro'eh behema gasa, afilu be'eretz Yisrael k'sherim. Person who is shepherding animals in Eretz Yisrael, the larger cattle, they are kasher. So now, the distinction that he makes is the distinction that's found in the Mishnayot in Psachim with regards to Behema Gasa and Behema Daka, which is that they were gozer in Eretz Yisrael, that people should not allow their Behemot Dako to graze in Eretz Yisrael, as Rashi notes over here, because of Mishum Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, because it ruins the Yishuv. The animals, the goats, or the sheep, when they go out and graze, they basically eat everything in sight, especially the goats, and they leave a desolation after them. They destroy anything that's growing, and they leave nothing behind. They kill every plant, tree that's there. And so, Mipnei Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, they didn't want these animals grazing and wiping out all the vegetation and plants and trees that were there, because then nobody would live in Eretz Yisrael. So they were goes there by Behema Dakot in Eretz Yisrael, that you may not graze them. And so therefore, if you're in violation of that, Rova says, you're going to be pasul leidut, because you violated an isor, that at least exerid the Rabbanan, but you're doing it because of money, because you want to make money, or because you want your animals to graze over there. And so therefore we worry about you being kasher le'edut. On the other hand, in Chutzlarts, where there is no such gzeira, it's not a problem. With Behemoth Gasot, the Mishnayot and Psachim discuss whether it has to do with the Minhag, whether they allowed or didn't allow Gasot, but mostly what we say is that it's a gzeira, she'ena tzibor yechola modba. It was a gzeira that the people couldn't uphold because they need the Behemoth Gasot to plow their fields, to pull their wagons, and they need them for their daily activities. And so therefore you have to allow the larger cattle to graze in Eretz Yisrael. And so Rava here makes a distinction between Behemoth Dakot and Behemoth Gasot in Eretz Yisrael. Yet right before, Rava said that it doesn't matter when you're a Ro'eh, when you are a shepherd, if you're shepherding smaller animals, flock animals, or cattle, both of them disqualify you to be an eight. So that's a steer in Rava. The Gemara says, how megadlim itmar. It's the difference between whether you are bringing them up or whether you are a professional shepherd. If you are bringing them up, then you do not get disqualified if they are the larger cattle. You will be disqualified if they are the smaller animals. But when it comes to grazing, when you are a professional shepherd, they're not your animals. Profession is shepherding. Then in that case, you are disqualified whether it's large animals or small animals. And where it says, Hachanami Mistavra, that makes sense. Minikhtoni, the Mishnah said before, Nemanim alai shlosha ro'ei bakar. Then the Mishnah says that he accepted upon himself three ro'ei bakar, three shepherders of cattle, cowboys. And we said over there that they would otherwise be disqualified. My love, the edut. So over there it sounds like he's accepting them as being valid witnesses because they otherwise would have been disqualified. And that would be supportive of what we're saying here, that if you're a ro'eh bakar, you are automatically disqualified from being an eight. Rav says, lo, the dina. Over there, they were going to be judges, not edim. Dekanami, it makes sense. Dekanami, shlosha, ro'eh bakar. It says three. E, le edut, shlosha lomali. If it's an edut, why do you have to qualify three of them? You only need two for edut. Three is a number that's associated with the beitin. Velamai, the dina. So you're going to tell me the reason that they gave the example of three ro'eh bakar was for them to be judges. Ma'iriya shlosha ro'eh bakar. Why do you have to mention cowboys or cow herders? Right? Anybody. Kol, Beit, Lata, Lo, Gamrei, Dino, Nami. Any other three people they never learned who are Amaratzim, they should have the same din. Why did you specifically pick ro'eh bakar? You could say this about any three people who are not well versed in the Torah law. Then they are not qualified to be judges. And if you accept them, then that's fine, but they're disqualified because they just don't know. And so why did you pick Roy Bakar rather than just saying three Amaratzim? Hachikamar. Afilu hanid lo shlichi biyishu. The Roy Bakar have a double negative against them. Not only are they not knowledgeable in the precepts of the Torah or to adjudicate cases of pi halacha, they also live out in the fields. They don't live in the civilized areas. So they're missing a certain amount of sophistication or understanding of how people live when they live in a close society, in a city, and so on and so forth. So they're missing that aspect as well. So therefore, the Mishnah says, even though they're missing both aspects, if you accept them, then you can't back out of it according to the Chachamim. So now the Gemara says, so there, that's the distinction we're making over here, that Ro'eh Behema are disqualified no matter whether it's Behema Dakar or Behema Gasa. Whereas if you're Megadlin, if they're your animals that you're bringing up and you're keeping on your farm, then if it's Behema Daka, you are in violation of the Gezerah, the Takana in Eretz Yisrael, and then you'll be disqualified. If it's Behema Gasa, which is permitted in Eretz Yisrael, then you will not be disqualified for being an eight. Over here, the Rabbeinu Chananel says, Hani mile ro'e behema didhu. That's only if he's a shepherd of his own animals. About ro'e behema da alma, if he is shepherding other people's animals, lo, that's not the case. Chazaka in adam chote velo lo. People don't sin when it's not to their benefit. So that's what the Rabbeinu Chananel says. He's quoting the Gemara in Shnayim Ochsim that makes that distinction. But I think you have to be careful here because he does have a vested interest. When he is the shepherd, he is responsible for feeding the animals and taking care of the animals. And therefore he's going to get paid by the people who left the animals with him. So it is echote velo. He's sinning for his own benefit. He is feeding the animals this stolen feed, which he doesn't have to pay for now. And then he'll still collect the money from the owners of the animals. So there is an advantage to him to feeding the other stuff. It's not just a case where the animals will be provided the food by their owners, and therefore he wouldn't graze in other people's fields because he's sinning and no benefit to him. So you have to be careful about what the exact circumstances are of the situation by the ro'eh. But we distinguish between a professional shepherd who's disqualified all the time and versus a person who's got a farm where he's bringing up these animals. So now, Amar Yehuda, Stam ro'eh pasul. The default status of a ro'eh is pasul, like we just saw by Rava. Stam gabai kasher. On the other hand, when it comes to a gabai, the default status is that he is kasher. And that's what the Rashi says over here, that we will assume that he is an honest tax collector until we find him deviating from that and taking more than he's supposed to. And that's what Balei Tosafot say over here. The Ka'adalish Me'inon, coming to teach us, the Havagav Shiach Zira Gabai V'Mukhes, Pasul. Even if they return the excess monies that they took, they're considering Psulim. But lo domi l'shar gazlanim. They're not like other thieves. Sheikh Zero, when they give back the money, they return the stolen items that they are ksherim. First of all, these tax collectors don't know who to give the money back to, who they stole it from, because there are too many people. They stole from the public at large almost. They are now still involved in their profession. So they haven't left these ways. We worry or suspect that they'll go back to their old ways. So what he's saying over here is that, yes, you get a default status of being kasher. But once you violate that, it's very hard for you to rectify it. Because first of all, you're involved in this profession continuously. And number two is, it's not clear that you can give the money back to the true owners. And lastly, we are now suspicious of your behavior, and we won't trust you anymore. Avuad Rabbi Zera, the father of Rabbi Zera, Avad Gabyuta Tleisa Shnin. He was a gabai for the government. He collected taxes on behalf of the government for 13 years. Gaviata Reish Nahara Lamato, when the head of the river came to the city, head of the river seems to be some regional government official or some official that came from the king. Kihava Chazi Rabbonan, when he knew he was coming to visit in order to assess the taxes on that city, when he saw Rabbonan Amar Lahu, he would say to them, Lechami Babechaderecha, go my nation, go into your rooms. Kihava Chazi Inish Demato, when he saw people of the city, Amar Reish Nahara Ato Lamato, he says that the regional head or the tax assessor is coming to the city. And today they will shech the father before the son and the son before the father, meaning that they're going to take your money or they're coming to collect your money, and therefore they should go and hide. So the difference is by the Chachamim he's more explicit because he knew that they would understand the hint and they wouldn't say anything. So he gave them that more explicit hint and said, basically, get out of here, leave, because the guy's coming. And then to the Shara'am, he gave it in a more convoluted way. He hinted to them at that, so he wouldn't be accused of telling the people to run away or to leave on that day. Umiganzo Kuliyama, everybody would go and hide or not be available on that day. Kiati, so when the regional tax collector or the representative of the government would come to assess how much they should pay in taxes, Amalemi Mandi Boy, he's going to say, well, you want to sign us that? I have nobody to collect from. There's nobody that lives here. This is a small population city. You can't put that type of assessment on us. And he would get the assessment reduced, and so they would have to pay less. Kinecha Nafshe, when he passed away, Amarle, he said to his son, Rabbi Zera, Shkulo Tleisar Moi, Tzari Liv Isadinai, take those 13 coins that are in my turban or in my cloak, Vahadrele the Planya, and return them to so-and-so, I took it for him thinking that we would need that for the taxes, and in the end I didn't. So you see here the tremendous honesty by which he conducted the business, and that's what the Gemara is pointing out here, that they can be gabayim that are ksherim. And that's what Rabbi Yehuda stated, that the stam or default status of a gabay is kasher, until he demonstrates to us that he's not acting in a fair and honest manner. And we have an example of someone who was beyond fair and honest. He tried to protect the citizens of the city from the burden of taxes or the overburdening of taxes. And in addition, he was honest that when he took more money than he needed, he handed it back to the individuals. As you see, there are people or gabayim or muksim that can be honest, and therefore they should not automatically be disqualified from being edim. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Chavav Amud Aleph.